I think I was talking about ventilation, right? Anyone have any idea? Let's talk about ventilation. Inspiration and expiration are the two components of ventilation. Inspiration is otherwise known as inhalation, expiration as exhalation. But I was talking about intercostal muscles, I think, and the diaphragm. Now, the diaphragm works only in one way. The diaphragm, when it contracts, moves in which direction? Right, moves inferiorly. It goes from a dome to more of a flat shape. And that diaphragm is the floor of the thoracic cavity. So by contracting the diaphragm, you increase the volume of the chest because you drop the floor. There are intercostal muscles between the ribs, as the name indicates, but there are two layers, and they are antagonistic. So you have the external intercostals, more superficially arranged, and you have the internal intercostals deep to those, immediately deep to them. So they're in different layers, but they also have grain that's different. The grain of the external intercostals forms a V when you look at the front of the body. The grain of the internal intercostals form a lambda, upside down V, in other words. So they're attached differently, and therefore when they contract, they do opposite jobs. The external intercostal muscles are muscles of inspiration, just as the diaphragm is. And the reason they lead to inspiration is because when each external intercostal pulls, it's pulling on the rib below. And when they're all doing this from all the ribs at once, this lifts all the ribs in the cage. And because of the shape of the ribs, this makes the thorax wider, because they're kind of diagonally arranged. If you look at the ribs, when you lift them all, they're going to swing out more to either side. But also, the sternum comes out when you swivel the ribs this way, moves anteriorly. So the diaphragm drops the floor by contracting. The rib cage, by being moved by external intercostal muscles, becomes wider left to right and deeper front to back. So all three of these things combined, an increase in the depth, an increase in the width, and an increase in the height, leads to increase in the volume of the lungs. Well, it probably feels like you're sucking air in when you're inhaling. But really what's happening is that by increasing the volume of your lungs, you're decreasing the pressure of the air that's in your lungs, because you give it, the more room you give a volume of gas, the lower the pressure is going to be, because that gas is going to go anywhere it's able to go. It's going to spread out, in other words, and that means it's going to have lower pressure. So by increasing the volume of the lungs, what you're doing is dropping the pressure of the air in the lungs to a value that's below the ambient pressure of the air outside your body. And therefore, you produce a pressure gradient by increasing the volume of the lungs. So yes, it feels like you're sucking air in, but really what's happening is that by dropping that volume to a value below the air pressure outside, the air pressure outside forces air into your lungs. Because it's going, you know, it's that air is going to be occupy as much space as it can, just like the air in your lungs. All right, now that's inspiration. Expiration can be almost entirely passive. Or actually, it can be entirely passive, meaning that you don't really need any muscular contraction to exhale or expire. all you need to do is end the contraction of the muscles that we just talked about, external intercostals and diaphragm. When that happens, the diaphragm is going to go back into its relaxed position because of connective tissue that's connected to it, basically. It's what deforms it back into that position. And the ribs are going to drop back down on their own by elastic recoil. So you're really, when you're lifting the ribs, you're working against a spring, in a sense. And when you release that force, the spring is going to bring it back down. So everything that happened during inspiration will be reversed without actually exerting any muscles, just because of the elastic recoil. Well, that means you're going to decrease the width, decrease the depth, and decrease the height of the lungs, therefore decrease the overall volume. And now you pressurize the air that's in the lungs. When you give it less space, that means it's at a higher pressure. So now that you bring your lung volume, I mean your lung air pressure, to a value that's greater than air pressure, barometric pressure outside your body. In other words, you reverse the gradient. But whenever you have a gradient, whenever you have a pressure gradient, there's going to be flow from where there's higher pressure to where there's lower pressure. And now that means it's going to leave your lungs. Well, that doesn't necessarily happen as quickly as you would like it to sometimes. If you're just sitting there quietly, yeah, you'll just exert those inspiratory muscles and then relax them, do nothing while it comes back to down, and then use the inspiratory muscles again and then relax them. But if you want to blow out the candles in a cake, for instance, or any other reason that you want to have forced expiration, meaning get that air out of your lungs as quickly and as fast and as forcefully as possible, then you don't rely just on the elastic recoil. You get those ribs moving a lot faster, and you get the diaphragm going back up into its relaxed state a lot faster by using other muscles. Those are the muscles of expiration. So those include the internal intercostals, because of their arrangement of their grain, when they pull, they're pulling on the rib above them to come down. And that's going to, the elastic recoil is still helping, but the muscles are making it happen even faster. You also have abdominal muscles, though, that occur in layers. You have a rectus abdominis in the front, but you also have, well, you should be able to tell me what the layers are. You have three layers on either side of the rectus abdominis. What are those? You had to learn this in 201, right? You have external abdominal obliques, internal abdominal obliques, and transversus abdominis, all three layers. When you contract those abdominal muscles, that makes the abdomen smaller volume. Well, the abdomen is not filled with gas like the thorax is, like the lungs in the thorax are. The abdomen is filled with viscera, various organs mostly for digestion. And viscera, the internal organs, are basically water. They have a lot of water in them. They are as incompressible as liquid water would be. So you can't reduce that volume and just pressurize those organs. Those organs really just have to move somewhere. If you give them less space, they're going to go wherever they get squeezed into, which is upward. So when you bring in these abdominal muscles, like when you really blow hard, what you're doing is forcing all your viscera to jam up against the bottom of the diaphragm while it's relaxing, and that brings it very quickly up into the lungs and therefore squeezes on them. So your diaphragm never actively works for expiration. It only exerts itself for inspiration. And then it gets forced by your guts when you use the abdominal muscles for forced expiration. Now to 13. Here we're looking at the wiring that's involved in the brainstem for control of cyclic breathing. So this is ventilation. You know, you can think about it and you can modulate it. You can hold your breath up to a limit. You can breathe harder and deeper than you really need to if you think about it. But you can also totally forget about breathing and just let the brainstem take over and breathe appropriately for you, which is what you do most of the time. When you force yourself to breathe abnormally, your body will eventually force you to stop doing that and resume behind-the-scenes breathing. Well, this behind-the-scenes breathing needs to involve an oscillating neural circuit, one that goes back and forth in a period, because you only want to contract those inspiratory muscles up to a point, then you want to relax those for a certain amount of time and then bring them back into play again over and over. Well, the oscillating circuitry involves two major groups of neurons in the brainstem, one behind the other. So we have what's called the dorsal respiratory group, which obviously is dorsally placed. Dorsal, remember, in a human is the same thing as posterior. And then in front of that, or anterior to it, is the ventral respiratory group. Ventral is another name for anterior in a human. So notice that notice from the picture that they're connected to each other. But by working together, they create the breathing rhythm. They're kind of like the pacemaker in the heart, except doing a different thing. They're firing oscillatorily, or in a periodic fashion, and causing these muscles of inspiration to be contracted even when you're not thinking about it. But they're not the only two things involved. Notice there's other things connected to them, including neurons coming from higher up in the brain, which is the conscious part of the brain. And this is why you're able, up to a point, to override what your brainstem is telling you to do, or trying to cause your ventilation muscles to do, so that you can either hold your breath or intentionally hyperventilate, whatever the case may be. But that is going to, the reason that that's going to be a temporary situation is that if you hold your breath, obviously that's going to cause an increase in CO2. It's going to build up because you're no longer blowing that off, right? The CO2 is in your lungs because it got picked up from the blood. If you don't exhale that, that CO2 is going to build up in the blood. And then what happens? What is it? No. Exactly wrong. It's the opposite. Doesn't get basic. It will get basic if you intentionally hyperventilate, which is breathing too fast and too deep compared to your activity level. Why is it? So in other words, it doesn't get alkaline if you hold your breath. If you hold your breath, the blood is going to be acidified. Why is that, though? What is it that's actually happening? No, you have too much CO2 because you're not blowing it off. You don't want to be taking in CO2. You do take in CO2 simply because there's some in the air, but that's not what you're trying to do when you breathe in. You're trying to bring in oxygen, And when you exhale, you're trying to get rid of CO2 from your body. So when you hold your breath, you're keeping that CO2 in you, in your blood. So therefore, what happens? We've talked about this multiple times in here, not in even in 201. In 202 we have. Well, that's how your body's going to protect itself. But what's going to happen chemically? Right, exactly. The CO2 is going to react with the water in the blood to form carbonic acid, which is then going to dissociate into what? Bicarbonate ions and hydrogen ions. The more hydrogen ions you have, by definition, the more acidic your blood is. That's what pH is. It's a logarithmic measure of how many hydrogen ions are in a solution. And because it's a negative logarithm, that means the lower the value is, the higher the concentration of hydrogen ions. That's what low pHs are, high acidity. So that's what really is going to, that's why it's a temporary situation. If you continue to hyperventilate, your body will just force you to stop. If you continue to hold your breath, your body will force you to stop, but for opposite reasons. Hyperventilation gets rid of too much CO2, and that's going to force that reaction to the left, right? You see what I'm saying here? The overall reaction is CO2 and H2O become H2CO3, carbonic acid, which then becomes hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. Well, if you, the CO2 is on the left side of this. If you are hyperventilating intentionally, way beyond, you know, if you're just at rest, you don't need to be breathing so deeply. But if you force yourself to, because your brain, your conscious part of your brain is part of this neural circuitry, then that's going to remove CO2 from the left side. And therefore, by Le Chatelier's principle, everything's going to shift to the left to replace that CO2. That means you're going to get rid of hydrogen ions because they're going to recombine with bicarbonate to form carbonic acid, which can then split into CO2 and water to replace the CO2 that you blew off. So that means you're getting rid of hydrogen ions, too many. That means you're decreasing the acidity of the blood too much. You're making it more alkaline if you hyperventilate. Exactly the opposite problem from what will happen if you hold your breath. If you hold your breath, CO2 is building up in your body. That's going to drive this thing to the right. And therefore, the amount of hydrogen ions are going to increase, making your blood more acidic. Either one of those is bad, because as soon as you get away from the optimum pH, your proteins stop functioning well, right? Any given protein has an optimum pH, including all your enzymes. Okay. Let's go to 14. We're looking at the aortic bodies and the carotid bodies. What's the big deal about them? What do they feature? What are they made up of? We've talked about the carotid bodies and the aortic bodies before. Okay, what kind of thing are they? Now, the sinus refers to the relatively large diameter bag-like artery. The carotid sinus, that's just that beginning of that branch of the internal carotid artery. That's what sinus means in general, is a space. The carotid bodies are named for the fact that they are on the carotid artery and specifically at that sinus, but what are the carotid bodies made out of? What did you say? Yes, receptors, and specifically what kind of receptors? Chemoreceptors, not baroreceptors. We talked about baroreceptors also, and there are baroreceptors there as well, and on the artery, in the aorta as well. But those are totally different kinds of receptors, right? The baroreceptors are measuring the blood pressure by the amount of stretch of the arteries. That's not what we care about here in the respiratory system. What we care about is the chemical makeup of the blood. And this is exactly where this equation I was just talking about comes into play. Right? If you are not matching your breathing to the amount of CO2 production from your body, which is coming in through the blood, then you're going to perturb this either to the left or to the right, and that's going to cause an imbalance. So that's why you have carotid bodies, aortic bodies, and then also a population of cells in the medulla oblongata that are continuously monitoring the acidity, the pH of the blood. And that's what I meant when I said that when you cannot hold your breath anymore, it really has nothing to do with low oxygen. You still have a lot of oxygen actually available at that point. Instead, what's happening is the CO2 has crept up just a hair, just enough to make that pH a tiny bit lower, which these carotid bodies, aortic bodies, and medulla oblongata cells say, that's it. I'm not going to let this happen any farther. And so it forces you to breathe that CO2 out to reverse the process. Force that reaction the other way, to the left in that case. And if you know, the opposite is also true. Those same chemoreceptors will notice that you've intentionally gotten rid of too much CO2 by hyperventilating, and that's why it'll force you to, you'll pass out so that you won't breathe at all for a while, which will be appropriate if you've already been breathing too heavily, right? By breathing not at all, it will allow that CO2 to come back up to normal in the blood to restore the normal pH. But this is also why the folk remedy works for hyperventilation. What is that folk remedy? Breathe into a paper bag, which is just ridiculous that it's always paper. It doesn't have to be a paper bag. But if you breathe into a bag, you're breathing that same expired air back into your lungs. You're not getting it fresh. So you're taking that CO2 that you got rid of and putting it back into your lungs, and therefore it's keeping the gradient from being steep, and therefore keeping that in your blood, keeping the CO2 in your blood. Okay, let's go to 15 and talk about gas laws. In chemistry, you should have actually talked about all four of these at some point. Boyle's law and Charles law are just special cases of the ideal gas law, the PV equals NRT thing. It's just what's different about them, other than the guy that they're named for, is what is being held constant. So pressure, temperature, and volume are all interrelated when you have gases contained in containers, right? Well, if you keep temperature constant, which is what Boyle's law condition is, at a constant temperature, a volume of gas is going to be inversely proportional to the pressure, which by inversely proportional, that means as one goes up, the other goes down. And you already know this from common sense, right? If the temperature is not changing of the gas and you have it in a container and you make that container smaller, that's a decrease in the volume, you're going to increase the pressure. Or if you increase the volume, you're going to decrease the pressure. Well, this is exactly how the breathing I was just talking about when I talked about the diaphragm and the inspiratory muscles versus the expiratory muscles. This is the basis for that. By adjusting the volume, you change the pressure, and by changing the pressure either above or below barometric pressure, that's going to cause airflow either into or out of the lungs. That's how breathing works. Charles' law is very similar. It's just holding the pressure constant. If you hold the pressure constant, then there's going to be a direct proportionality between temperature and volume. In other words, if you had a rigid container, constant pressure, not a rigid container, a rigid container with a lid acting like a cylinder, right? So the lid can move up and down, but the walls of the container are rigid. Well, and that holds a gas. If you have a weight on top that the gas pressure is lifting, basically, and you heat that thing up, it's going to push even harder, right? Which means it's going to move that weight up. This is how internal combustion engines work, or piston engines at least. Could be a steam engine for that matter. Anyway, that's Charles' law. Dalton's law has to do with gas mixtures, which air is. Air is not a gas. It's a mixture of gases. Each gas has what's called a partial pressure, which is that particular gas's contribution to the overall air pressure. All right, so we can measure air pressure by any number of units, including pascals. What Dalton's law says is that if you have a mixture of two gases, let's say it's 75% gas A and 25% gas B, if the overall pressure is, let's say, 100 for simplicity, 100 pascals, then the gas A is going to have a partial pressure of 75 pascals, and gas B is going to have a partial pressure of 25 pascals. In other words, each individual constituent gas in a mixture has a partial pressure equal to the total air pressure times the concentration of that gas. In other words, the fraction of that gas, the total fraction of that gas. Does that make sense? Well, what are the constituent gases in air? What is it mostly? Nitrogen, right. And what does nitrogen do to the body when you breathe it in? Effectively nothing. Nitrogen is inert. Now, it's an important component of your nucleic acids and your proteins, but when the nitrogen goes into the blood, because it will, just like carbon dioxide and oxygen can, it doesn't really do anything in there. It's inert. It comes into problem in the bends, but that's an unusual situation when you dive and come up too quickly. So nitrogen is most of air, but it does really nothing for us. That nitrogen, because of its triple bond between the two nitrogen atoms and a nitrogen molecule, we can't break that. So we can't use that nitrogen for our own purposes, which is one of the reasons we rely on bacteria to live. Anyway, as far as a respiratory gas is concerned, it's not a respiratory gas. It's just the major part of the air, though. About 3/4 of the air is nitrogen. What else do we have in the mix? We do have some oxygen. About how much? A little bit more. 20.95% oxygen. So that's, you know, over a fifth of the air is oxygen. That's pretty high. What else? Carbon dioxide is in the air. Now, unfortunately, this is the one that's going up, and that might kill all humans eventually. Not even too far off, maybe. But the CO2 level used to be about 380 parts per million for however many thousands of years until humans started burning fossil fuels 150 years ago or so. Industrial Revolution. That's really the beginning of the global warming problem we're in right now. But now it's up to, I actually don't know what the current level is. Maybe it's as high as 400 ppm by now. Doesn't seem like much, but that's enough to cause the global warming that we've already recorded and that is going to worsen according to models. That our models keep getting updated. We're actually being more conservative than than we think we should be. So it's actually keeps turning out to be worse than we thought over and over. Anyway, it's a small fraction of the total amount of gas in the air. Roughly 400 ppm is not that much, right? 400 parts out of every million. So not nearly as much CO2 in the air as O2. The rest of it, well, the biggest variable component of air, because there are traces of neon and argon and things like that that are just negligibly small percentage. But what is the other component that actually changes more than all the others day to day? What other gas? Well, think about it. Not hydrogen. Doesn't change very much. Well, what about when you're watching the weather report? What else do you exhale besides carbon dioxide and nitrogen and oxygen? Water. Yeah, water vapor is a component. Water vapor is gas. And so it can go from almost none in a really dry day to saturation in a day that it's raining. So that is, it's always a component of the air, but it's the one that actually goes up and down with the weather. The others are all, for a given altitude, well, actually, no, irrespective of altitude. The percentages of the others are basically, the only reason they change is because when you change water's percentage, that slightly tweaks the percentage of everything else. All right? So anyway, that's Dalton's law. Whatever the fraction of the total is for a gas, that fraction times the total pressure is the partial pressure of that particular gas. And the reason partial pressures are important for the respiratory system is because that's the gradient. It's a gradient of partial pressure that these gases are moving around in response to. So unless you have a partial pressure gradient, there's not going to be a net movement of gas from one compartment to another. There would be just as much movement in one direction as there is in the reverse direction if there's no gradient. So what this means is that for the respiratory system to operate for its main job, which is to deliver oxygen to the blood and to rid the blood of carbon dioxide, there need to be partial pressure gradients independent of each other, but for each of those two gases. And they need to be in opposite directions. So, because the direction of the gradient is what determines the direction of the movement. Oxygen doesn't know to go into the blood. It only does because the inhaled air is going to have a higher partial pressure of oxygen than the blood does. Now, importantly, gases dissolve in liquids. So we still talk about partial pressures even when we're talking about the liquid in the blood. Okay? Oh, I didn't talk about Henry's law. Henry's law has to do with the interface between a liquid and a gas. So at the surface of a liquid, like a lake, for instance, whatever the pressure is of the gas that's above that liquid is going to determine how much of that gas gets dissolved in that liquid. In other words, if you can somehow pressurize the gas that's above a liquid, what you're doing is forcing some of those gas particles to be dissolved by the liquid because of that higher pressure. On the other hand, if you reduce the pressure of the gas above it, that's going to force a bunch of those dissolved particles out of solution, which is exactly what happens when you open a beer. That's why it does the sound it makes. Or any carbonated beverage, it wouldn't have to be beer. But by opening up that top, you're now all of a sudden giving that gas above the liquid a lot more space. That immediately lowers its pressure. And so fewer of those particles are being forced into solubility, and they come back out of solution. This is exactly, by the way, what happens with the bends. If you come up too fast, the nitrogen that got dissolved in your blood because of the extreme air pressure forcing it into your blood at depth of water now comes out of solution, and that forms bubbles in the bloodstream, which is bad news. Okay, anyway, these all relate in one way or another to respiration, but I wanted to just cover them individually. Let's look at 16 now, much of which we've already talked about. But the bucket analogy here is kind of good. The handle of this bucket is roughly shaped like the ribs, making up the rib cage. Now, not all the ribs are connected in front and back, but most of them are. They're connected directly to the vertebrae in the back. In the front, they're connected to the sternum, but indirectly via the cartilage that's at the hyaline cartilage that's at the sternum, which is called costal cartilage. But anyway, they're connected front and back, except for the last couple pairs. Anyway, they're shaped more or less like the handles of this pail, but they're hanging downward below horizontals. That darker one right here is horizontal, but normally, after you've already exhaled and you just pause there, the ribs are in this downward position where it's kind of grayed out here. Well, they're in this position right here. When you lift that handle to the horizontal position, notice that it swings outward. You know, if you had this in a room where the handle was right up against the wall, you wouldn't be able to do that because the room would have to be wider for this to swing outward. Well, that outward swing of the ribs is what causes the left to right, the width increase that I was talking about. But it also, because of the way it pulls on the sternum, is increasing the distance from the front to the back of the rib cage. And those are both caused by action of the external intercostal muscles. And those are the only ones that those are the only increases in dimension that the bones are involved in. But at the same time that you're causing those external intercostals to contract, you're also causing the diaphragm to contract, which is what turns it into its arch shape, into a more of a horizontal shape. That's what drops the floor. Well, when this happens, like I was saying, this increases the volume, which decreases the pressure. So during an inspiration, the pressure drops below barometric. Barometric pressure is higher, and therefore there's a gradient that forces the air into the lungs. Everything's reversed on the way out. Oh, on the bottom right here, you see this is what I was talking about, the sternum moving back and forth as the ribs move. 17. The graph, notice, is lung volume, so the y-axis is volume. And time is on the x-axis, even though it's not listed. That's why this curve is going up and down, up and down. Each up and down is a breath, a total breath cycle, meaning one inspiration as it's going up, one expiration as it's going down. All right, now, the point of this overall graph is that we define various volumes and capacities for the lung. Now, first of all, everything that's called a capacity on this is a collection, a sum of volumes. Some of these things are called volumes. That's just a volume, obviously. Now, any things that are called a capacity is also a volume, but the reason that they get a different name, capacity, is because you're adding together two volumes that are already defined to make a bigger volume. Okay? Now, the whatever color this is, a crew band. It might be nude, I don't know. These short amplitude waves, that is just normal, relaxed breathing without thinking about it. So if you hook a person to a spirometer, which is what this device is for measuring the change in volume in the lungs, you're just going back and forth, not moving all that much air. Because you're totally at rest, you therefore don't need to ventilate very much. All right, so that is called tidal volume. That's one of the volumes. Tidal volume because it's tidal breathing, right? In and out is the tide. Now, if you do that for a certain number of breaths, you'll make this part of the curve. Then, if you take as big a breath as possible, as deep a breath as possible, you know, it, while you're normally breathing, you're breathing in, and you would normally reverse that and breathe out. But at the top of that normal breath, if I say, okay, now continue to breathe in as deeply as you can above that, which would be this part right here, that additional volume above the top of the normal breathing is called inspiratory reserve volume. It's a reserve volume because you have that in addition to your normal breathing if you need it. And it's inspiratory because you're bringing the air in. All right? Then you can let that out and breathe normally again. But after a normal exhalation, you still have air in your lungs. And I could tell you, okay, after you normally breathe out, before taking that next breath, continue to breathe out as much air as you possibly can. That's the opposite of inspiratory reserve volume. That's the expiratory reserve volume. But no matter how hard you try, you can't get all that air out of your lungs. Notice that the nadir, or low part of this dip right here, still is at a positive volume. There's still air in the lung. And that amount that's left in the lung is called the residual volume. Okay, residual means that it resides there, it stays there. Now, it's not exactly the same air. It does get mixed. But the point is, you can't collapse your lungs enough to get all that out of there. So there's always going to be some air in there. Okay, now we have... So those are all of those had volume as the in their names. Like I said, all the capacities though are sums of these various volumes. So notice what functional residual capacity is. It's the sum of residual volume and expiratory reserve volume. What it really means functionally is how much air is left in your lungs after you just normally exhale without forcing any more out. Okay, you always have that residual volume, but you also have what you could normally force out. So if you combine those two, that's called functional residual capacity. Vital capacity, well, let me do inspiratory capacity first. Inspiratory capacity is the sum of tidal volume and inspiratory reserve volume. You can think of this, though, as being how much air you can take in maximally after a normal expiration. So from the bottom of this to the top of this. All right? And then vital capacity is the sum of all three of these: inspiratory reserve volume, tidal volume, expiratory reserve volume. The vital capacity is that sum, but you can think of this functionally as being the total volume of air that you're able to move in and out of the lungs. You can't move the residual volume, so it's everything else. And these volumes and capacities go down as we age. Well, they go up as we age originally. As we develop into adults, they get higher and higher. But, you know, 20 or so is probably when these are highest in most people's lives, depending on the conditioning. But eventually you lose some elasticity in the lungs and whatnot, and these volumes can go down. They're also, in general, greater for males than females, but obviously there's some exceptions to that. Well, in 18, there's no new information here. This is just, in words, the definitions I just gave you. There is new information. It gives you typical values for each of these, in case you're curious, but I don't want you to memorize those values. And I just included it because it might be a good way to put it into words rather than in pictures. 19. Well, I was talking a little bit ago about dissolving gases in a liquid. So that happens for any given gas, but it's not just the pressure, like Henry's law was saying, that matters as to how much gets dissolved. It also is that what kind of particle that is. In other words, different gases dissolve better or worse than other gases in a liquid. It also depends on what the liquid is, but here we're talking about water because that's basically what blood plasma is, right? Well, carbon dioxide dissolves a lot better than oxygen does in liquid. And by the way, speaking of the global warming problem, we've added so much carbon dioxide in the last couple hundred years that, well, things would be much worse than they were as far as the greenhouse effect is concerned, which is caused, among other things, by carbon dioxide in the air. Well, that greenhouse effect would be even worse than it already is if a lot of that carbon dioxide that we've added over the last couple hundred years did not get dissolved in the ocean, which it is able to do pretty readily because, like I said, it has a higher solubility in water than oxygen does. The problem with that, though, is, yeah, the greenhouse gases problem isn't as bad, but now we've actually measurably acidified the ocean for exactly this same reason. That CO2 that's coming from the air and gets dissolved in the ocean reacts with the water and forms carbonic acid. So the ocean is becoming more acidic, which is putting a lot of things on the brink of extinction. But anyway, both oxygen and carbon dioxide are dissolvable in water, just to different degrees. They are going to be, the blood is either going to be loaded with or unloaded of either of these gases, though, depending purely on the partial pressure gradient. And just like for solid solutes, like salts, what was I trying to say here? Just like for solid solutes, damn, I really have no clue. It must not have been very important. Anyway, direction of the movement of these things depends only on the direction of the gradient. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Just like for dissolved solutes, solid solutes in a solution, if you have multiple different kinds of solutes, they all have their own gradients that don't affect each other at all, right? And this is why O2 is going to move in one direction while CO2 moves in a completely opposite direction at the same time, simply because the gradients are reversed. What we see in the beakers is that if there's a lot more of oxygen, which are the blue balls here, in the air space in the lung, in the alveolus, than there is in the plasma, that's the partial pressure gradient that actually causes the movement to be much more in one direction toward the blood than in the other direction. If you just keep things as they are, though, and stop breathing for a couple seconds, it's going to come to equilibrium. When it comes to equilibrium, that by definition means there is no gradient, right? And so there's going to be just as much unloading from the blood as there is loading into the blood. They're going to move in both directions at the same time. There's no net movement at that point. There has to be a partial pressure gradient for there to be net movement of gas, either from the gas to the liquid or from the liquid to the gas. All right, we'll continue next time.